Well, welcome everyone. It's nice to see the early birds here. I barely made it myself. My name is Carrie Miles. I'm currently living in Orange, California. I am the director of Empower International Ministries. It has a mind of its own. And Empower International Ministries is a group of volunteers. We work with leaders in developing countries. We're in 9 African countries in India. And we're teaching partnership in marriage, which is quite a radical notion in developing countries, where you pay for your wife with cows or goats, and she's the worker in the household and not a companion. So we have a Bible-based program. Oh, I hope there's not a password that addresses that. I have a doctorate in social and organizational psychology. I'm married to an economist, and we have 2 grown children. So I'm talking today about the topic is hookup culture, same-sex marriage, and the collapse of religion in the West. I don't know what a sex gap is, by the way. I didn't write the abstract. But maybe it will make sense as we go through this. My husband teaches an economics of religion class, and one of the assignments, he sends his students out to visit different churches and to report back on what they saw there and any surprises. And one young man in his class reported back that his sister's friend had become a born-again Christian. And when he started attending a local evangelical church, someone at church told him that he probably should stop sleeping with his girlfriend until they got married. And his response was that was the most ridiculous thing he had ever heard. Now, for a young college student in Southern California, I suppose the idea of premarital abstinence is a ridiculous idea. But what's surprising is that he'd never heard of it before. Now, this is a pretty young crowd, but for people my age who'd be coming to Sunstone, the idea of not having sex before marriage was sort of the defining principle of our young lives. So it's a surprise to me, anyway, that this idea is completely foreign to some young people. So I'm going to talk about how we got from here, or from there, to here. So I'm going to start pretty briefly with how economic forces shaped the traditional family. What were the reasons for the kind of Ozzie and Harriet family that we have in mind? I need you to go back a little farther than Ozzie and Harriet, though. Maybe the Little House on the Prairie, even though that's pretty late. But think back, if you can, to things that you've heard from about 1800. This is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But before the Industrial Revolution, and pretty much in a lot of the developing world today, or some of the developing world today, everything that people used, everything they needed to survive, was produced in a household. So you grew your own food, you cleaned your own beans, which could take 4 hours, preparing grain to cook could take equally long. You made your own fiber, you wove your own cloth, you made your own clothing, you grew your own animal, cattle, sheep, goats, whatever you were eating, butchered them yourself, made your own leather, made your own shoes. Everything that you had to survive was produced in a household. Now, households might trade among themselves, but everything that was there had been produced in a household. So households were sort of a little factory, and you needed a lot of people to generate enough things to just get by. Okay. So you either had a lot of servants, but preferably you also had a lot of children. Children were an economic necessity in this kind of world. And you needed them not only for the labor, but also to take care of you. Servants could never really be trusted. They had their own interests at heart. And often they were saving up enough money so that they could get married and go start their own household, unless they were slaves. And slavery was very common in this kind of world as a way to have enough people to working together in order to survive. But you needed children for that security and as a source of labor. And because children tended to die in the pre-industrial world, child mortality was very high. A woman might spend her entire life either pregnant, trying to get pregnant, nursing children, caring children in that way. So women become what economists call domestically specialized, because when there's all this work that needs to be done and everyone's pitching in to do it, but people learn almost immediately that there is some work you cannot do when you're pregnant. And if you do very hard, strenuous, or arduous labor, when you're pregnant, you lose the baby. If you're breastfeeding and you work too hard, you lose your breast milk, and then the baby would die because there was no substitute for human milk, breast milk, until really quite recently. So women do the work that are compatible with pregnancy, and that tended to be the work that kept them in the household. So they had just massive amounts of work to do, but it tended to be things that they could put down when they needed to pick up a child or that didn't tax them overly. And this domestic specialization made them dependent on men, because the men now are doing all the things that the women can't do, and he's doing the things that involve power, that involve status, that involve education, because he's interacting with other men out in the marketplace.
I'm going to take this offline. This is not my computer. All right, from current slide.
So the men become obsessed with power, with status, with their control of the situation, and they bring that home. So as a result of that, every culture has developed some form of the marriage contract in order to protect the woman in her childbearing role. She is less powerful relative to the man, and he has this strong incentive to use her up and then discard her and replace her. Okay, because just like I mentioned with my ministry, in developing countries, marriage is transactional. He buys her, she owes him things, he owes her things. This is the way the world was. We don't realize exactly what marriage is in a kind of natural environment, because we're building on 2,000 years of this Christian heritage, which taught us something very different. But Every culture has some kind of marriage to protect woman in her role as childbearer. And it might be a written contract, it might just be customs and laws or codified in the common law. Okay. Now, here's where we get to the part that relates to how we got from there to here. Because marriage was this kind of cost imposed on men. Men wouldn't have wanted to make that commitment otherwise. Okay, it was not in their best interest. You had to motivate men to marry. And he's essentially marrying her. He's making this commitment that he's going to take care of her for the rest of her life, or else pay her off in some way, in exchange for her sexual products. Right? Now, if she gives her sexual products, her children, women's work, sex, if she gives him those things for free, he's not going to make that upfront transfer. Are you following me? Okay. So I'm looking at traditional sexual morality as a kind of feminine cartel to motivate men to get married. And it's this very culturally enforced whole system of rules and laws and customs about how women could behave that essentially made sure that no one was giving it away for free. Okay. And so traditional sexual morality usually took the form of the double standard, where the woman's behavior was very much regulated by her husband, by the other women in her society, by the church. They enlisted the churches and the schools and everyone to enforce that morality. But it's a double standard because those rules apply to her, but they don't particularly apply to the men. The men are free to behave however they please. So that's why it's called a double standard. Okay. So we have this kind of Jane Austen kind of world. Jane Austen's writing just kind of at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And if you ever saw Pride and Prejudice or read the book, there's the whole kind of subplot where the younger daughter runs off with a soldier, and she thinks he's going to marry her, but he's not marrying her because they haven't provided her dowry to him yet. And the whole family is in this blind panic because they're gentry. Her father's a gentleman, but he can't. His daughters can't inherit the estate. It has to be a boy that inherits the estate. So when he dies, the girls are going to be out on the street. So it's desperately important that they marry. But this sister has now ruined the whole family reputation. And unless they salvage that situation, they're all going to starve to death, you know, or end up on the streets. So this was the world prior to the Industrial Revolution. Okay. Now what happens in about a little before 1800 is that the Industrial Revolution is dated to about that period. And we usually think of the Industrial Revolution as Ford making cars on an assembly line, but it actually begins much earlier. And we're going to think of it in terms of production leaving the household. Everything was being produced in the household. Now that production is leaving the household. And in about 1790, a man invented this way to mill wheat into separate the bran from the white part of the flour. And this is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution as far as the family is concerned, because people preferred white bread. But wheat is a hard grain. You couldn't mill it at home. And you had to separate the white from the brown part. It would spoil very quickly. So you couldn't have a lot of it ground at once. So it was expensive to grow wheat because you had to keep making these trips to the mill. So instead, the staple of the American household was corn, maize, which people grew at home. They did all the steps, and you know, the men would do part of it, and the women would do other. And they had cornbread, and that was their household staple. Well, with the invention of this partially automated wheat mill, within a couple of decades, it becomes cheaper to buy wheat flour than to grow your own maize. So this is kind of the beginning of the movement of production out of the household. So now this task that kept men busy 80% of their time has gone away. But he needs cash to buy the wheat flour. And at the same time, you're getting piped in water. You're getting fuel-efficient stoves, which is a big deal. The open hearth, which is what people had usually used to heat their houses or cook on, was very inefficient. Now you have those little pot-bellied stoves, like Ben Franklin stoves, and that's much more efficient. So now you don't have the men at home, but now you don't need all those children, okay? All those children that you'd had before. In 1800, the average American woman had 7.3 children in her lifetime. Okay, that's a lot of children. And those of you with pioneer heritage here in the state probably had grandparents, great-grandparents with 10 kids in the family. Okay. So you don't need all those kids to carry wood, to carry water anymore. And the world is changing. Now these kids are going to have to be educated. So production starts leaving the household. Here are different dates when different things left the household, began to be taken over by the marketplace. It was more efficient now to have somebody else do it, and you earn the money to buy it, than to do it yourself. The whole kind of landscape changes. In 1800, about three-quarters of the population were living on farms, producing things, agriculture. It drops almost in half 100 years later, and then by 2000, it's like 2%, and those aren't family farms anymore. I don't know if there are any family farms left at all, but they're big agricultural factory farming of. And so now we've moved to a situation where little or nothing is being produced in the household. This is going to take about 150 years to accomplish, but it's going ongoing steadily throughout the 19th century. And children become an expense. Okay? So we'd seen that dropping birth rate. How do I go back? That's a problem. Somewhere in here I have this chart with the dropping birth rate. So the average woman in 1800 had 7.3 children in her lifetime. By 1900, she has 3.4. By 2000, she has about 2. And it's kind of held steady around 2.1, 2.2 in the United States. But that's because we have so many immigrants coming in from other countries, and they're still having kids. But the average kind of woman of European ancestry in the U.S. has well below 2 children. And we see in Italy, throughout Europe, in Japan, that we're way below replacement level. It's like 1.2 children per woman. So the birth rates drop considerably because children have become so expensive in the modern world. I think the latest estimates that to raise a child from infancy to age 18 costs about $250,000. That's not counting university. It is counting the value of the parent time that's lost when you could have been working that instead you're spending on children. So children have become enormously expensive, and then you have to put them through college. If you live in an urban area, it's even more expensive to raise a child. So the birth rate has dropped as a result. And the point of all of this economic arguments is that we tend to do things that make sense economically. You know, if it didn't make sense, if it's not even possible to do it, it's just way too expensive, then we don't do it. And we tend to norm our expectations on that. So people now assume that, you know, having 8 kids is just kind of crazy. You know, most people are not going to do that. So everything in this way of looking at the family depends on the economic value of children. Now, children have no economic value. They become very expensive. They're fulfilling emotional needs, status needs, rather than economic needs at all. And as a result, women are no longer dependent on men in the same way. Okay, if she has a child, it doesn't make a lot of difference. Maybe, you know, if you're married and he wants a child too, okay. But it became impossible to sustain that marriage or contract once that children no longer have an economic benefit, okay? You can no longer require a man to support a woman for the rest of her life in exchange for the possibility of her bearing a child. And so what we saw was that about in the 60s, then the divorce rate begins to soar. We switched from marriage as this contract where you have to go to court to sue someone to break it, to one that can be initiated by either party, and it's unilateral or no-fault divorce has become the norm, where if one person wants out of the marriage, they can just end the marriage, and you might argue for the next 20 years about the property settlement or custody of the children, but the marriage itself is over. Okay. And marriage itself is becoming increasingly expensive. Young people can't afford to get married at the young ages that they used to. The age at marriage has soared. Oops, okay. So I can't go backwards, apparently. So the age at marriage, first marriage, has soared over the last, the 50s were an aberration, but people used to get married in the early 20s, you know, 20, 22. And that has gone up. Now the average is about 27, 29 for men. And this doesn't capture the increasing portion of the population that have never married at all. So today, just 20% of the adults in their 18 to 29 are married, compared with 59% in 1960. Many of you who are my age probably got married when you were in your early 20s, and probably those of you who are in your 20s now are not married. Am I right? Okay. So the whole kind of structure of marriage is collapsing. You can no longer make a contract to be married forever. And the basis for marriage has changed. In Jane Austen's that Pride and Prejudice I was talking about, is all about, do you marry for love or money? And because these girls know they have to marry for money, but they have this romantic stuff going on. And fortunately for them, it all works out. But in modern world, marriage is, if you marry for money, you regard it as being really quite indecent, quite immoral. There's no economic transactions going on. Love used to be regarded as too fragile a basis to build a marriage on. But now it's the only basis for building a marriage. Okay, this romantic love, feelings of sexual attraction. And if you don't have those feelings for each other, then you're counseled to, you owe it to yourself to leave the relationship. You know, you owe it to him, if you're no longer sexually attracted to him, to leave him so that he can find someone who will love him as he deserves to be loved. Okay. So one thing that happened was that by the middle of the 20th century, so much production had left the household that the mother who was still in the household, the men had left the household earlier for the marketplace, and they just come back at night. The children were increasingly out of the household and going to school during the day. The home, by the middle of the 20th century, was no longer a center of production, but a center of consumption, where the housewife was there alone all day. And by the middle of the 20th century, there wasn't anything that she was producing there either. Okay? Now, there's still a lot of work to do, especially if you have children. You still probably couldn't live very comfortably by yourself in the middle of the 20th century. But the woman wasn't producing anything at home. And so you have the women's movement beginning. And women flock into the marketplace in the 60s and 70s. Let's see if I can go back. Okay, so women just float into the marketplace because, like the men 100 years earlier, it's more efficient for her to get a job and buy the things that she used to produce than to continue to produce them at home. And indeed, you know, think about the things that were women's traditional products, weaving, making clothing at home, knitting. You know, today if you want to knit a sweater, you have to buy 20 little balls of wool about this size, and they cost $10 each. And then when you make the sweater, your son won't wear it anyway. So it was very rational for women to get jobs. So we see this vast influx of women into the workforce. Okay, so the last piece. The last piece in this is that if children are no longer economically valuable, and you can no longer sustain a marriage contract to protect the woman in her role as dependent childbearer, you don't need traditional sexual morality either. You don't need that very painfully enforced feminine cartel that kept her from having sex before marriage, that kept her from giving it away, right? So we see concurrent with the women's movement, with the drop in the value of children, economic value of children, the collapse of traditional sexual morality. So in the 60s, we now have the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution wasn't any change on the part of men's behavior attitudes because that's how men always wanted to behave. But now the women were free from these constraints that they had been imposed on them. So we have in the middle of the 20th century the availability of the pill for the first time. Now, people have somehow been controlling their births since 1800. But for the first time, we have enough people who are demanding reliable birth control that that it becomes commercially available, something that, that everyone could depend on. So we've got the sexual revolution, the women's revolution, and the pill all at the same time. So the world has changed dramatically, and the traditional family now has changed dramatically as well, with people getting married older and older, cohabiting, having sexual relationships before marriage, very few children, and marriage itself has become increasingly expensive, more of a luxury, just as childbearing had become a luxury, something that perhaps only the rich or the reckless can afford. Okay, so what does this... Oh, okay, so hookup culture now is the latest manifestation of this. In the 60s, people were arguing about whether you could have sex without a committed relationship. Now the situation has progressed to the part where you can have sex without any relationship at all. And hookup is what goes on where you have young people massed together. I don't know what it looks like when they're out of college, but it's been mostly studied on the college level. And hooking up is where you go to a party, there's usually alcohol involved, but a guy and a girl, it's primarily heterosexual, get together and they go off someplace together and they hook up. Now, what exactly a hookup is purposefully left vague. There's still enough remnants of the women's sexual cartel that the girls don't want to get a reputation for being too easy to hook up with or going too far. But it could be anything from, you know, kissing, sexual touching, oral sex, to full intercourse. The thing that the researchers who've been studying hookup culture says is it's not so much that's what is done on a hookup that defines a hookup as your attitude that's supposed to be towards it, which is that casual. It doesn't matter. There's no strings attached. You've heard that expression, I'm sure. So the hookup culture, you have the hookup, and you might see that person you hooked up with in the hall the next day, and he won't even make eye contact with you. And fathers who hear about, you know, from their sons about hookup culture said, you don't even have to call? You don't even have to send flowers, you know? So it's quite a different situation than what it used to be. But the idea is that it's casual and you have, I can't use the expression, but friends with benefits, I guess, is a way to put it, where you might have someone that you have sex with perhaps on a regular basis, but there's no real relationship there. Okay. And there have been a couple of movies about whether this is really possible or not. A lot of people will hook up because they want it to develop into a relationship, but that often doesn't happen. About 11% of the people surveyed were happy with hookup culture. They found it very empowering. About a third of the college students didn't participate at all. And then the rest, 50-some percent, had very mixed feelings about it. And there's potential for a lot of miscommunications in a hookup and a lot of hurt feelings and people feeling used afterwards. And I think looking at the high prevalence of sexual assault on college campuses, this current situation doesn't provide a whole lot of support for young people for their sexual lives, how they should be behaving, how to treat each other. And I detected some hostility on the part of the men towards the women. It's sort of like the popular culture in high school run amok, where the guys get status from hooking up, and the better looking the girl he hooks up with, the more status he gets. So he's out there bragging about it, whereas the girls, they still have to keep their numbers down. So there's some dynamic tension there. Okay, so what's the impact of this on religion? Oh, okay. Go through the rest of my slides. I'm not sure you can read this very well with the lights on it. But with the sexual revolution, we have, these are the rates of different generations. This is extremely generational, the way you're behaving sexually, the family issues. But the pre-baby boom generation, about 48% reported, these are women, reported having intercourse before marriage. Now, a lot of these women had intercourse, but just with their fiancé. Okay. And as they, younger and younger generations now report a higher rate. And in 2013, 94% of the women between the ages of 15 and 44 reported that they had had premarital intercourse. And now this pattern of the older generations where they'd had intercourse with their fiancé and then married him, this kind of situation is quite different. If you start having sex when you're 15, you're going to have more than one sexual partner in your lifetime. So the rates of numbers of sexual partners have gone up quite a bit. And of course, premarital births have gone sky high. And the new family unit is increasingly looking like a woman, her children, and then the man of the moment. My daughter told me that she's 28. She said young people today are serial monogamous, where you'll have a relationship, not married, and you're faithful to each other. That seems to be the one abiding value, is that when you are in a committed relationship, you don't cheat. But those relationships are transitory. So the modern family unit, and we're seeing this all over the world, in Africa, in South America, and so forth, is increasingly becoming a woman, her children, and then these father figures who rotate through on a sporadic basis. Okay. So, same-sex marriage. If marriage is now based on feelings, emotions, it's sexual attraction, then there's no reason for it to be heterosexual anymore. In the traditional world, marriage was, by definition, it was to protect the woman in her role as childbearer, right? It had no meaning outside of a heterosexual context, okay? And there was no benefit for two men marrying each other. This is what we're seeing in Africa, some of the countries there have passed very restrictive laws about homosexual behavior there, because they're still dependent on sexual complementarity. They still need the things that women did as opposed to things that men did together in marriage. So in the traditional world, people didn't think of homosexual attraction as being a different category of identity. They just thought these were lustful people, or maybe they're a little off somehow, but they're just a normal person, no different than anyone else. And it's not until the 19th century, when you're kind of halfway through this process with the Industrial Revolution, that you even have the word for homosexual, and that you start developing the concept of gay identity as being distinct, something different from a heterosexual identity. But for the modern world, and especially the young adults today, the folks under 30, marriage is all based on sexual attraction, right? So if two people are attracted to each other, then why shouldn't they be able to get married? And whereas there was no economic benefit to homosexual marriage in the traditional pre-industrial world, because so much of the household functions have been assumed by the government, assumed by the marketplace, there are a lot of benefits that you tap into with legal marriage now that are available outside the family itself. So, you know, inheritance rights or adoption rights, and just a whole a whole lot of things that are available to married people. So now you're seeing this drive for homosexual rights. And so we see the red line on top was the number who used to oppose same-sex marriage, and the blue line is kind of the converse there, the number that approve it now, and we see it crossed over a few years ago. So it's a situation now where the things that are being supported by the economy are the things that make sense to us, all right? And just in May, the Arkansas Supreme Court ruled that there was no rational reason to oppose gay marriage, same-sex marriage. Okay, so there's no rational reason anymore. If you're opposed to a lot of the things that are happening now, you come across as hateful or whatever. And I say it's very denominational. So what happened in the churches? I'm going to go back to the birth rate, which I'm using as kind of a proxy for this whole movement. And we see the birth rate was declining from about 1800 on, pretty sharply declining. And then we hit the Great Depression in the United States, and then World War II. And the birth rate takes a real dive then, because people just can't afford to have children, and then the men all are gone. Okay. Well, what happens after the World War II is all these men come home. We tend to norm on the 50s. We'd look at that as being what the family was about, or that's when everyone was going to church. That was the big period when we had all this religious interest. Well, what happens is that you've got all this pent-up demand. 80% of the men in the United States who were born in the 20s served in World War II. So when World War II was over, you have 12 million men coming home. And you've got this enormous shortage, this huge demand for housing, for marriage, for children, for jobs. So the whole kind of structure of the United States goes into hyperdrive here. The age at marriage for girls fell. Well, of course, it had been depressed because the men were all gone. But it fell to about 19 on average. The girls were getting married very young because you had all these men who have not been able to get married for the last 10 years. You have this huge pent-up demand for marriage. And so they all get married. They move to these new suburbs. They're building suburbs like crazy. And they start having kids, and that's the baby boom. Okay, so the birth rate goes skyrocketing up. Yes? Yeah, I need to go faster. Okay. And you have people who are in new communities. They need communities. They've been through war. They've been through hell for the last 4 years. So you have churches growing like crazy. So you have this huge boom in religion. So here we have what's going on at the same thing. And the traditional family and religion, as they're practicing at them, are this great fit. They're really reinforcing each other. So it's mom, American, and apple pie. You know, motherhood and apple pie everyone has the same sort of set of values, the American way. Then you have the communist scare, so you've got them all united against the communists. The interesting thing about this period is that there's no political distinctions in the pews. Okay, at this point, you could be attending a conservative church but be a liberal. You could be a liberal, a conservative and attending none of the churches were terribly liberal then, but a more mainstream church. There was no connection between your political position. I'm actually over time, so I'm going to run through this quickly. But what happens here is that when you have, I'm going to take the example of the Catholic Church, what happens in the 60s now when this all starts falling apart, because the 50s were an aberration. We're going to go back to those trends that have been happening all along, right? And it's all going to break out in the 60s. But what's happening in the churches now is take something like the Catholic position on birth control. The early part of the 19th century, all the churches agreed that and all most Americans, that decent people didn't use artificial birth control. And so what you have is a situation like this where religious teachings and the social norms coincide. This is what you have in the 50s. What the churches are teaching, what people, how people are living, they're coinciding. Well, now you've got those economic factors come back into play, right? Those children are expensive now. And so the new social norms are shifting this way. They're shifting left to allow birth control. But the church is still over there. They've got this eternal truth, right? And what happens was that some of the churches decide that as the norms move this way, they're going to move even farther that way. They become even more conservative. And what happens with the Catholic Church is that they come out with rules now. They never had an encyclical about use of birth control before. It was just assumed that, you know, you didn't have to make rules against it. No decent person would do it, right? But now a lot of people are doing it. So in 68, they publish a papal encyclical saying you should not be using artificial birth control. As a result, this enormous drop in Catholic practices. Enormous. Now, at the same time, they've had Vatican II, which liberalized a lot of their other church processes, like the way the religious orders were treated, and the Mass was now being celebrated in the local languages instead of Latin. So that was a very liberalizing thing going on. So what happens is that, you know, if you do something that's real conservative, you're alienating the people who have to behave differently. And if you do something that's very liberal, you're alienating the folks on the other side, right? The folks who've always done it that way and who liked having the Mass in Latin or have already had their 10 kids and don't like the idea that now people are looking down at them. So you take any of those issues that I've talked about and you've got the same process happening. And as a result, as a culture, we have no middle ground left anymore. There's no economic support for a moderate position on these things. So where there used to be a lot of economic support for getting married when you were 21, it's almost impossible today. People can barely support themselves, let alone a family, at that age. And this became very politicized in the 70s and 80s, so now all of the conservatives are on the right and all the liberals are on the left, and the liberal churches have been bleeding members. First, they lost them all to the evangelicals. You had this huge growth of evangelicalism in the 70s throughout the 80s, but now they've peaked too, and they're starting to lose members. So this is why I say it's led to the collapse of religion in the West. And so I had better shut up. But you can see where Mitt Romney got into problems, because his appeal is over here, but those folks hate Mormons, right? So these folks weren't going to vote for him, and these folks had pretty mixed feelings about him as well. So it's really quite a different world, and I will step down now. You played into my next slide. You know, when pollsters would ask people about their religious preference, people would usually say, well, I'm Catholic, or I'm Baptist, or I'm Christian, or something. And in the last, relatively few years, it's a millennial phenomenon that's young adults under the age of 30. Increasingly, people are saying they have no religious preference. And this is growing. You have to update this every year because the number is growing so radically. So the number of people who claim no religious preference and don't go to church is now become one of the largest religious groups in the United States. For the young people, we're up around 26% of nuns. Yeah, they're not atheists. Atheists are still regarded as being kind of not nice. They might say that they have, a lot of them say they have a strong connection with nature and the earth, or they'll say they're spiritual but not religious. Or they'll be off on some alternative Reiki, which is some Eastern practice of some sort, is very popular. So it's just the nature of religion is changing, but the institutions themselves are increasingly losing credibility and adherence. And then we have, as they say, it's very generational. And we have very poor data with LDS Church, because they're such a small group, they don't show up in the national surveys very well. But from the General Social Survey, this is a panel study where they go back to the same people again and again. And when they asked people who'd self-identified as LDS at age 16 if they were still considering themselves LDS in a later survey, you know, up until about 2000, this is when the millennials come online. Yeah, the millennials are defined as young people who come of age in about 2000. Okay, so you've got about 93% of the Mormon youth who are still self-identifying up until about 2000, and now that's dropped to 64%. So this is pretty big. And the church is supposed to be concerned about massive losses in this age group. The poor is where you're seeing a lot of this kind of alternative strategy now with the mother, the woman with her children, and the men who rotate through. Cohabitation tends to be for people with lower socioeconomic status, lower educational levels, the poor. It's become increasingly difficult to get married. And there's a study by Kafala of inner city women who, you know, they want children, they all have a few kids, and they want to get married. They have the same kind of white wedding fantasy of everyone else. But the men available to them are too sketchy. They're too unreliable. So they'll have children with these men, and the men will, you know, bring them a box of Pampers or something, or help them somehow with the kids. But the women won't marry them, even when the guy wants to get married, because they're such poor risks. And men often, part of why the marriage rate has gone down is that men will often take resources away from a woman and her children now. So it is very much a class phenomena, and college-educated, most people are cohabiting now before they get married, but for college-educated folks, people with higher SES, socioeconomic status, they do marry at their cohabitation ends in marriage. So it is becoming a rich versus poor sort of thing. And I think it's really going to be only the elites that marry in the future. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out the motive for the churches to be moving right on your graph. On the one hand, maybe they feel as if their congregants are not hearing them, so they say it louder and bigger and move into to the punishment phase of that graph. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, perhaps some of them some other churches and their logic or their politic is to move to the left on the graph to at least have some affinity, some identity with their congregants who are moving to the left. So within the family of churches, aren't they also dividing? Some moving left, some moving right on that that series of bell curves.
Yeah. Well, we just had a major schism in the Anglican Communion with groups breaking off from the Episcopal Church in the United States and forming a new congregation. This was around the issue of the ordination of a gay man as bishop. The Episcopal Church in the United States is currently splitting because they dropped the requirement. See, I'll take that as an example. You didn't have... The Presbyterian Church in the United States started ordaining women in about 1958. The PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America, split off at that point. Okay, so whenever the churches make a move in either direction, you're shedding people. In this case, you're having actual schisms. When the sexual revolution starts now, they're starting to get people in the pulpit, lesbians in the pulpit, people who want to be ordained as elders who are sleeping around or cohabiting. Okay, so the culture's moving this way. What's the church going to do? Well, the Presbyterian Church is, the decisions are made on a denominational level by people in the General Assembly, where every diocese sends representatives. Okay, so they've been in furious arguments for the last 70 years over these issues. So there was no rule that you couldn't be an elder if you were sleeping around, because it had never been an issue before, right? You didn't need to make a rule when it was unthinkable to do that, right? So they passed this amendment that said that you had to be either chaste if single or heterosexually married. Okay, that was the only place that sexual activity was acceptable. And they fought about that for 30 years, and they recently repealed it. And so now all of the more conservative congregations are dropping off and joining other Reformed denominations. So it's really a damned if you do and a damned if you don't situation.
I'm trying to understand, this graph, this table has to be very concerning to a lot of Mormons. And the question, I was in a state conference meeting where people were the state presidency was openly discussing crisis of faith and loss of membership. And what was claimed was that in the older generations, the concerns were around having been taught things that turned out not to be true about Joseph Smith or the Book of Mormon or various things like that. But in the younger generations, the concern that was expressed was, quote, fairness, unquote. Which to me meant women and gays. And so the question is, how much of this number is attributable to sexuality, and how does that play out? Can you be at all specific about what people are feeling? Is it that Mormon kids want to sleep around, or is it, how does that play out?
That's a pretty tough question. People used to get married when they were 20, 22. And if you look at the age distribution, how old people are when they get married, which I cannot find, but last time I saw it, it's kind of normally distributed around whatever the average is, which is now up around 28. But there's this little bump at the young end, around 20. And those were traditionally the Mormons, the Southern Baptists, and other kind of fundamentalist folks, because they were... The conservative response to the sexual revolution has been the purity movement, which is... they have these rallies where they're chanting, sex is great, but you have to wait until you're married, and getting little silver promise rings, which the father would give her daughter, and she'd pledge that she wouldn't have sex until she was married, and true love waits, this big movement in the evangelicals. Well, that kind of culture is unsustainable, too, and it's very harmful, because they're still policing each other. And they're being told, you know, you can't wear that, and you can't flirt with that boy, and you can't be friends. And the whole kind of courtship thing that came up in the early 90s was you weren't supposed to date. You were supposed to court. So a young man would see a girl that he wanted to marry, and he'd go to her father and ask permission to court her. And then they'd have this chaste courtship. And the goal was their first kiss would be at the altar. Very, very difficult to sustain that. You have to be in a cult, you know, to do that. And then what happens when you leave your little Bible college where everyone's policing each other? Because people can't, I mean, they're getting married at 20 because they can have sex then. Right? But most people can't do that. How are they going to live on their own? 25% of 22-year-olds are still living with their parents. You know, but if you're not part of the purity culture and you're both part of that like-mindedness, and you can't afford to get married until you're in your late 20s, what's going to happen if you want to have any kind of relationship at all? And that was the problem with the hookup culture, is the people were complaining that 50-some percent that participated but didn't like it. If you didn't participate in that, there wasn't anything else. You know. So how are you going to have a relationship with someone who thinks that waiting until you're married for sex is the most ridiculous thing they've ever heard? How are you going to survive? How are you going to make a relationship if you're not having sex? I mean, it's a really untenable situation. And I see it in my own kids' lives, and it's painful.
My question. Do you have any advice? What would you tell 8-year-old girls about to embark in this environment, or their dad?
Well, I found that your kids will talk to you about this until they start participating, and then they clam up. There's a woman named Donna Freitas, Freitas. She's written Sex and the Soul, and I can't remember what her latest book is. And that might be, and she's the one who did all the studies on this. So you might have them read that. If they know what's going on and why, it might be helpful. Certainly, I'd tell your girls if they go to parties, don't drink. And if you're drinking, you know, whatever, a glass of water, don't leave it unattended. There's a lot of date rape drugs being used. I mean, I hate to say it, but it has gotten kind of predatory out there. And our culture just sort of treats kids like pieces of meat. You know, they're just there for marketing.
Well, plus, I would also say that, you know, we should be teaching our sons to not sexually assault.
Yeah.
So that's important for our career.